WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The play The Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity by Christopher Diaz uses the exaggerated role-playing of professional wrestling to explore myriad other themes. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2010 and is the next production at Carolina Actors Studio Theater. We're going to visit with Christopher Diaz as well as the artistic director at CAST and the lead actor later in the program. But first, a relatively new band with some familiar names at the helm. David Childers and Bob Crawford have both been on this program before and have been influential in different ways on the American and North Carolina music scenes. David is a singer, songwriter, guitarist, author, rock and roll lawyer, and aficionado of Americana music. Bob Crawford is the bass player for the Avett Brothers. They formed the band Over Mountain Men, and both of them are in our Spirit Square studio this morning, and I should say welcome back, but they are not in the position really to talk at the moment because they're getting ready to play. So I thought we would kick it off this morning with some music so we'll know what we're talking about, and then we will talk with them about their music. The Over Mountain Men, and a song, a little historical song here about Alexander Hamilton. This is a first.
1, 2, 3, 4. Men here want to take me down, down to the dirt, drag me around, but I persist, will not abstain. Run the need to explain. Oh, it's a short life. I pretend that it's easy being me. Oh, it's not easy when you see. That inspiration is a curse, but doing nothing is much worse. My arguments, though not planned, put my own blood on my hand. Oh, it's a short life, and I cannot pretend that it's easy being me. It's not easy when you see. I've a need to defend Alexander Hamilton. I know with truth I'll never win. Here I go. I sit alone in my room for weeks, affecting what must be, refuting the enemies of my ideals, and the scandal thrown in me. Palisades we go to reach the morning shrouded spot, a place to silence bitter words, ways for ending jealous plots. Oh, it's a short life, and I cannot pretend that it's easy being me. Oh, it's not easy when you see. How they need to defend Alexander Hamilton. I know the truth, I'll never win. But here I go again.
The Overmountain Boys, that is David Childers singing and playing guitar, and Bob Crawford on bass. Put your instruments down, guys, and come on here and have a seat, and we'll talk about all this here. They just played a couple of concerts in the area in the last several days, and they've been touring around the country and continue to do so. We have information about all that on our website at WFAE.org. So pull that microphone up there towards you, David. Alexander Hamilton is a person I never thought I'd hear a song about.
I never thought I'd be involved writing one of them.
I mean, he's on the money, but that's about all people know about him. But this album and the last album, the first album, deal a lot with American history and historical things. Why?
I think that's what brought David and I together. We back when the Avett Brothers were first starting out, and David had the Modern Don Juans, we did touring together, our two bands, and David and I became friends, and it doesn't take long to realize that David is quite a Renaissance man, a lover of music, art, literature, history, and he's just a fountain of information and a very amazing spirit. And so American history kind of tied us together. It's something we could talk about a lot, and he had a lot of fascinating insights into it. And in fact, I would read a lot of political history, and David would read a lot of military history. And so that was always fascinating for me to get a perspective that I didn't spend time studying battles and certain generals and this and that. And so David was always a real interesting guy for me to talk to because, believe it or not, there's not a whole lot of people out there in my world that I can talk to about 18th century American history. I know it's hard to believe. You go to a bar and just no one wants to talk about that kind of stuff. But David was one of those guys that I could communicate with and relate to.
And in fact, the first album was recorded near Kings Mountain.
That's right, yeah.
And that's the name of the band. The Overmountain Men comes from the Battle of Kings Mountain, doesn't it? And I have two dates for that. I have 1740 and 1780, which is correct.
1780.
Yeah, 1780. October 7th. 17.
I believe it's October 5th, 6th, 7th, somewhere in that.
So what is what?
And let me just say, that was David's son Rob, who produces our records and plays drums and helps write the songs. That was his.
Those two, idea. You and Robert came up with that.
Well, we were in the studio and we didn't have a name for this project. And Rob just started talking about the Battle of Kings Mountain. And it was Rob talked about the Overmountain Men and kind of was describing what they were like, and that was where the name came from. I just wanted to throw that out.
Okay. So where does the name come from? For people,
well, they were you jump in on this, but they were basically a branch of the Virginia militia, and they had been serving the King of England for years in the French and Indian War, even as late as 1776. They defeated an Indian confederation up at Point Pleasant, West Virginia. A really hard-fought battle out in the woods along the Ohio River. That was 1776. They were serving the king, and 4 years later they came out of the hills because Patrick Ferguson threatened to burn their land, farms, and steal everything from them if they didn't come over. And you know, if you deal with people in the western part of North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, and Virginia, you don't say things like that to them. So, you know, this group formed, and they came down and They fought Ferguson's militia at King's Mountain. They were all Americans fighting.
Yeah, Ferguson,
there was one European, which was Patrick Ferguson.
Patrick Ferguson was a major general in the King's Army, and he was the only regular in the whole battle. And so if you think about the Revolutionary War in the South, you're talking about a civil war. And it was either loyalist to the crown, or it was the rebels, or it was those that were fighting for independence. And a lot of the Overmountain men, like they came from kind of everywhere. A lot of these guys came from the eastern Tennessee, the other side of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and they weren't allowed to settle there. You were only allowed to settle on the eastern side of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and these guys went crossed over, and their battles on a daily basis were with Indians, but they had gotten involved. Ferguson was threatening them, saying, "I'm going to come get you. I'm going to come over there and get you." And he got one of their brothers. I can't remember whose brother it was, caught him and said, "You know, you send them this message. I'm going to come get them." And they came over to get him. And it really, that battle, Thomas Jefferson felt that that was the battle that turned the tide of the whole war.
Wow.
It was very it had a political undertones.
So this is all on the album, right? I'm just kidding.
there is a song about an unfortunate fellow at King's Mountain.
Whose idea was this collaboration? How did this come to be? Because I know that Bob, you were out there with the Avett Brothers, and they were getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and touring and touring and touring and playing. You know, you guys appeared on this program years ago, and then you appeared on Letterman. We can't get you anymore. So,
Mike, we'll be here anytime you want us to be here. Let me first say that.
And let me tell you, them boys, they don't forget where they come from.
Well, and I think it doesn't change, for us. I mean, we've always appreciated this show and you and, it just.
So how did this start? How did this collaboration?
2006, we did a thing at the Verizon Amphitheater. It was called Essex Fest. Mm-hmm. That place holds 18,000 people. We had about 2,000 people come out for it. But the day after, I was driving to Asheville to do some recording, and I got there early, and I sat in my car, and I had heard rumors. I'd been hearing rumors for weeks that David was retiring from music. And it was kind of a say it isn't so mm-hmm. moment. Mm-hmm. So I called him, and he said, it was maybe time for him to kind of like just write songs, but kind of not play as many shows and this and that. And I just asked him, I was like, well, if I send you some song ideas, would you want to kind of write songs together just for fun? Let's just, I'll just do stuff on the computer, record at home and send you files, and maybe we can come up with some neat ideas. And we talked about history, and I remember talking to David, and we talked about how Washington, David brought this up, Washington came home from the Revolution and went back to Mount Vernon and was like literally sanding his floors and like, doing these like these things that we do on a daily basis. And the idea
we don't want to do,
we hold these founding fathers up or great men in some ways, these great men in history. We hold them up to a level that is not human. Yeah. But yet they had hopes and dreams and tragedies and had a lot of mundane days, just like we all do. And the idea of writing songs that captured that was very exciting for me. And
because in truth, they all put their pantaloons on just like we do, one leg at a time. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Bob Crawford is with us along with David Childers. They are the Overmountain Men. Their new CD is called The Next Best Thing. And information about that and where they're playing and more is on our website at WFAE.org. We'll come back and hear more music and talk some more about all this in a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Diamond Springs, offering bottled water, coffee, and filtration services to the home or office. More information about Diamond Springs at 800-715-2286. The murders of school children at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut have reignited the gun control debate, and in last week's State of the Union message, the president gave an emotional plea for gun legislation. Proponents are ready to move, but opponents of gun control don't want to budge. So, is there room for compromise? Can we both protect a citizen's right to own and bear firearms and the right of others to feel safe. We'll take a look at both sides tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama proposed the biggest expansion of early childhood education in decades. Debate over the value of universal preschool.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Bob Crawford with the Avett Brothers and David Childers with David Childers. And they're both together with the Overmountain Men. Their new CD is called The Next Best Thing. A minute ago, Bob alluded to the fact that he had heard that you were getting out of the music business when this group came together. And I know that you were on the show several years ago, and it looked like things were beginning to take off for you, David. You had a couple of CDs out, and things were going well. And evidently, things didn't go as well as you wanted them to. And you decided at one point that, well, maybe I should just concentrate on being a lawyer and give this up. What was that like?
It was very difficult, very, very sad. I was also just physically and mentally at a point of exhaustion. It felt like I was just pushing up against the wall. It's hard being a grown man trying to keep a roof over your head, take care of your responsibilities and obligations, and, do what we were doing. It was just, I needed to be two people, basically.
And what
and plus, there was a lot of long travel, very little reward in it.
Right.
You'd have enough.
Very little monetary reward or very little reward?
Well, very little monetary reward, and after a while, very little artistic reward, because we're playing. I was in a band that was just kind of playing the same stuff over and over and over and over, and going to the same honky tonk bar, doing openers for some pretty, for some really good bands, that kind of thing, but it just wasn't. Wasn't moving along. I just felt kind of ridiculous. Really.
Meanwhile, you've been on this rocket ship, Bob, because the Avett Brothers, like any band, struggled at the beginning. And I know you've morphed and changed over the years into something other than what you were when you started out. You have a new producer and all that kind of stuff. But even with the success that you guys have had, that's got to be very difficult, traveling and putting up with all of that. And then you've had some personal situations with your daughter, and it's been hard, although rewarding.
Very rewarding. And I would say up until last year, I would say that I had achieved all my dreams, pretty much. It's like we had done even at this point, if that band ended tomorrow, I would be able to get out of the music business and feel like, well, I did everything that you can possibly do, and we had a great level of success at it.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, because you're the bass player with them, but you've been with them, I think, since the very beginning.
2001.
Right? But their name's on it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is your thing, you and David's thing, the Overmountain Men. Does that make it special in some way? Is it different in some way? Or is it just another way to express yourself musically?
It's special because I'm doing it with David, with my friend, and I believe wholeheartedly, 100% of my soul and being believes in what David does and what he creates, and that it is more than valid and that it should be heard by as many people as humanly possible.
Describe what David does.
David has a knack of writing songs that create a world of intimacy. And that was the exciting thing about writing like historical songs, like taking a song like we all like Davy Crockett, from a Walt Disney movie, but writing a song about Alexander Hamilton that is more touching and then can breathe life into that person. But David could do it. If you brought out the Charlotte Observer from today, you could probably point to any article in that newspaper, and David could probably write you a song based on that article that would make you cry.
Wow.
I mean, and
I don't know how accurate it would be.
I think in this day and age, a man like him is hard to come by. And like what I said earlier, I alluded to a Renaissance man, and
yeah.
I think he's the truest sense of a Renaissance man. So that's what makes this so special for me.
Okay. So you don't have to be accurate because it's poetic license.
But I put my pantaloons on one leg at a time.
That's right. You know, sometimes I forget how to put my pantaloons on. But
now, we use the word pant. Let's be clear about this. We used that word because we were talking about George Washington, for crying out loud. And their pants only came to their knees back.
But we got our Revolutionary War suits on here.
Okay, so. Yeah. Now, not every song on these albums, on these two CDs, is necessarily historical. And there's one on this thing called Death Is So Romantic. Explain that song to me before you sing it.
I don't know. It's just something that came out of me. I guess it. No, I could explain. I see, and I was one of these guys, going a million miles an hour when I was very young, smoking 2-pack cigarettes a day and just living for the moment. And that's okay. I appreciate that very much. But, Jack Kerouac died young, and it's just like, I learned early enough, fortunately, where that kind of life of dissipation and constant partying leads you. In my late 20s, I gave up drinking and smoking and have tried to keep myself in pretty decent physical condition. But, I see young people that they just think there's something very romantic about it.
Hmm.
Look at Rebel Without a Cause, Do that kind of thing.
Well, let's hear this. You guys stand up and we'll get you set up here and we'll hear Death Is So Romantic, which is a part of the Next Best Thing CD that these guys have just put out. This is the Over Mountain Men.
Death is so romantic to the very young, who drink and dope and drive too fast and think that dying's fun, thinking if they think it all the day we'll get a pass, just like in the movies till the world kiss their death is so romantic, waking every morning to the sad, hungover world, to the weak and worthless wages of sin. One day they're turning 40 and things are moving slow, and then they're almost 50, they're out of time, we know. Death is so romantic. Death is so romantic to the very young, who drink and dope and drive too fast and think that dying's fun. And then one day death's at the door, beckons come along. They ask for just a little more time to make right out of wrong. Failing kidneys, failing hearts, they cannot catch their breath. That's all you get, there's nothing left. Come go with me, says death. Come go with me, says death. Death is so romantic to the very young, who drink and dope and drive too fast and think that dying's fun.
The Over Mountain Men, David Childers and Bob Crawford. Death is so romantic from their CD, The Next Best Thing. Have a seat, guys, because we can't talk in these positions for some reason. We have limited microphonies here. That's a modern, old-fashioned word for microphone. It goes in with pantaloons. What does this collaboration do? Because both of you have had individual careers and long careers in music. What does this bring to the table for the two of you? Different. That's different.
Oh, well, see, Bob doesn't credit himself enough. Like that Alexander Hamilton song, he brought that to me almost. I mean, it was mostly written. And I you know, messed around with it. I honestly didn't like it that much at first, but he brings – no, but we were – but and I love it now.
Yeah.
It brings me a whole different approach. He has an approach to songs that I don't have. It's just a point of reference, and I really like it. It's opened up that to me, the possibilities that I can – a lot of times I have sent him lyrics, and he's brought it, you know, back with a song. That's when we started this. I'd had a lot of people say, oh, you're a great writer, this and that, but nobody would play the songs, record them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's co-write, but, you know, nothing ever comes of it, and for whatever reasons. Bob was really the first guy that took these things and said and did something with them. And, you know, he sent me MP3 where he'd gone out and hired all these students. And I said, this guy is very serious. You know, he's not just shooting a bunch of bull.
So how do you explain that, Bob? Why? How do you explain that? That you're the first guy to be able to do that?
I don't know why I'm the first guy. I don't know if I even believe that.
Well, it's true.
Just because, again, it's like, you know, I've learned a lot very recently that your free time, okay, if the Avett Brothers is my full-time job, when I have time to mess around and do something musically other than that, and when I can justify, because I have a family also, you know, it's got to be something I really, really want to do and I'm passionate about. And you know, playing music with David is something that I'm that passionate about.
You're from New Jersey, is that right? How do you explain your being able to fit into this kind of music so easily? It's like a hand in a glove.
I went to my first, and this isn't bluegrass, okay? Mm-hmm. But there's like bluegrass people like, you don't know what bluegrass is, boy.
That's
but I attribute it to this. I went to my first bluegrass festival in New Jersey in 1992, and I immediately felt a connection with that music. I felt, you know, when you're in a rock band or you're hearing rock music, it's like you're listening to, and there's like distorted, you know, distortion on guitars, and there's drums and whatever. You're listening to something, and it's like someone's shouting at you.
Uh-huh.
But when you listen to acoustic music, it's like someone's whispering in your ear. I've always kind of felt that. And so when I first was truly introduced to what would be acoustic music, true acoustic music, like roots music, I felt like someone was whispering in my ear, and it touched me very deeply. And so a friend of mine invited me to go to Merlefest in like 93 or 94, and I began coming down from New Jersey to go to Merlefest. And at some point when I graduated college in 95, I decided that if I moved to North Carolina, every day would be like Merlefest, which was not the case. However, that is the root of why, you know, I love this kind of music. And when I first met Scott and Seth up at the Media Play parking lot at the university area, when we first had our like audition, I didn't know what it was that we had played. I didn't know what to call them. I knew they weren't bluegrass, but I drove away from that meeting thinking, this is something I want to be a part of. It was the first fruition of the whatever that kernel of truth that brought me down from Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, playing with them in that parking lot was like, this is that thing. This is that thing I was chasing for many years.
I read somewhere that this collaboration, Over Mountain Man, began as kind of an all-night jam session at a Ramada Inn in some little town in Virginia. And that's when you started playing around and just kicking ideas around and writing songs. What is the writing process like? Do you get together regularly? Is it just back and forth through emails and stuff?
A combination. And what we've done is email back and forth. And then we've had times where we've actually sat down, usually over at my house, mm-hmm. with a four-track recorder and go into some things. But mostly it's you know, long distance. I don't see Bob all that often because of where he is. You know, right now, and that's, you know, just the way it is.
Yeah, there are 12 songs on this CD. I don't know how many there were on the first, but I'm sure you've written more than the 12 songs that are on this CD. Is that right or wrong?
Yeah.
So how do you decide what makes the cut, what doesn't?
Well, I think Rob Childers has a lot of say in that. Rob does an amazing job with these songs and kind of taking the forms and giving them a lot of structure and then like producing them, his input, I mean, makes them what they are in a lot of ways. And Rob is that filter. He has a sense of
what works together. We argue, but I always defer, you know, in the long run.
If you think it's funny to play with two, to be the third guy with two brothers, how about being the other guy with a father and a son? That's interesting.
Who had a very lenient father.
Let's talk about that psychologically. What's wrong with you, Bob?
I'm an orphan in this world.
That's right. So this is the second album. The first CD was really favorably reviewed by a lot of people around the country. This may be too soon because it just came out for you to get any gauge on how it's been received. But do you know how it's been received?
What I've read has been, I feel like it's been received a lot. Definitely more people are aware of it.
Right.
And that the reviews have been stellar. Everything I've read has been just beyond what I could have expected.
Is it more difficult, because you've been through this process twice, once with the Avits and now with this group, is it more difficult to produce the second CD than it is the first, particularly if the first kind of got people's attention and got favorable praise? The second must come with some pressure attached.
But I think the first one took from 2006 to 2010 or 11.
Something like that.
Right? Yeah. So, because we didn't know what it was going to be, and it kind of, we just did a lot of, like, I recorded the song and sent it to David, and then he re-recorded it and sent it to me, and it was like this, like, very nebulous, kind of like, we're going to do something, and it just kind of took forever, you know. Once Rob got really involved and we kind of got the band together and we did one, we had a template. So it made the second one just like almost like clockwork.
Does the second one stand on its own or is it building on the first?
I think it builds on the first and it's a nice next. It's the next best thing. I mean, I look at that my collaboration with David and the Over Mountain Men as being a lifetime, like I look at the Ava Brothers, being a lifetime thing. And it doesn't have to, I hope we never reach the very top of the mountain. You know, it's like a matter of we're on this musical journey together.
But how do you have time to do both?
Well, it gets tough. You know, with my daughter got ill last year, and that has kind of become the main thing in my life. I took almost a year off from the Avett Brothers because of it. And so this has really got pushed back in a lot of ways. Yeah. And my time with David is even more precious because it's so limited. But I believe that if we allow enough space in between album releases, and if God blesses us, we'll continue to do these.
Only have 30 seconds left, but you admit that this is not a commercial venture. So where does it go from here?
To the next record.
Yeah, if it goes, it's a success. If there's a third record, it's a success.
Bob Crawford and David Childers, they are the Over Mountain Men. Of course, Bob plays bass for the Avett Brothers as well. Their new CD is called The Next Best Thing. What was the first call?
Glorious Day.
All right. And both are available at music distributors all over the world through the internet, of course.
On Ramsor Records.
Ramsor Records. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Information about all of this is on our website at WFAE.org. We're coming right back with Chad Deity. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Heartwood Tree Service, protecting the strength and beauty of bare trees in winter through research-based structural pruning. Tree guidance available at 704-525-3066 or online at heartwoodtree.com. President Obama proposed the biggest expansion of early childhood education since Head Start was launched nearly 50 years ago. Last week, during his State of the Union message, Diane Rehm and her guests talked about the debate over the value of universal preschool in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a play the likes of which you've probably never seen, and it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize several years ago. It's the upcoming production at Cast, and we'll talk about that and meet the star, the playwright, and the director when we come back.
Shootings and other violence have prompted a new wave of proposals for stricter gun control laws in America. WFAE is hosting a public conversation Voices in the Gun Debate. Panelists will share diverse views on the topic, and you can join the discussion Tuesday evening at the Blumenthal's Booth Playhouse. You can find more details on this free community forum and register to attend at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Professional wrestling has deep roots in Charlotte. Its popularity seemed to spring from the red clay of our soil, and many of the sport's most notable personalities called and continued to call Charlotte home. The sport is known for the exaggerated role-playing of its most popular wrestlers, and that characteristic is the stepping-off point for a consideration of other themes, from globalization to ethnic stereotyping in the 2010 Pulitzer Prize finalist play, The Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity. It is the work of playwright Christopher Diaz, who won the 2012 New York Times Outstanding Playwright Award for this satire of professional wrestling. And in advance of the play's opening on Thursday at Carolina Actors Studio Theater, he joins us by phone from Brooklyn, New York. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Michael Simmons, who is the artistic director at CAST and the director of The Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity. Good morning. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And J.R. Jones is the actor playing the title role. What is that around your shoulder?
This is my World Wrestling Championship belt.
Where did you get that? Is that real?
This is a real belt.
He won it.
I won this, yeah.
Are you a wrestler?
Me personally. I'm not a wrestler, but...
So what you're telling me is that your character won it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Chad Deity.
Never breaks character, does it?
Never. That's not allowed.
People who don't know CAST don't understand that this is something that you guys do. It's very weird, Michael. I got to tell you, you have actors rehearse in strange places as their characters.
That's what makes CAST.
Okay, if you say so.
And it also proves that theater can be a contact sport.
Yeah.
There you go.
In addition to being a Pulitzer Prize finalist, this play won the 2008 National Latino Playwriting Award, as well as the 2011 Obie Off-Broadway Award for Best New American Play, and it was playwrights like James Lapine and Lynn Nottage, among others, who chose you, Christopher Diaz, as the New York Times Outstanding Playwright in 2012. What do awards like these do for a playwright and for the life of the plays they write?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think the biggest thing is the life of the play. You know, this play started out in Chicago. We moved to New York after some good reviews out there in Chicago. But when the award recognition started coming was when the play got published, and then it was able to make the rounds and get down to companies. Like CAST, to do the work the way that Michael's talking about, which is very, very exciting.
Yeah, I have not seen it, obviously, because it hasn't opened, but I did read it, and it is so much fun to read. It must be a blast to see the character Mace, Macedonia, is that his name?
Macedonia Guerra.
Yeah, calls professional wrestling the most artistic expression of the ideals of the United States, to which Chad Deity, the other wrestler, adds, pick him up.
Power bomb him.
Go ahead.
Pick him up, power bomb him, pin him.
Yeah. Now that may be difficult to understand without hearing all the other lines, and there are many that lead up to that statement. But I think
a lot of words.
Yeah, but I think it's right. Yeah, you must think so as well. So when did you come to that conclusion, Christopher?
It's sort of an ongoing question. But the biggest thing, we talked about this a little bit in the play, is that there is. Everything takes two sides. Anytime you're creating a hero, you need to have the guy who loses to the hero. And there's something that feels really specifically American in that way. And when you deal with the context and the history of oppression and racism and all those different things, there's always two sides to it. Sometimes we only get to hear one side of the story. And so what I've been watching and studying professional wrestling, you realize there's something else happening there. There's some reason that folks are really interested in this art form. And it is an art form. Yeah. We talk about that a lot in the play as well.
Well, I read that you were asked by a friend in college, because you were sitting around watching wrestling on television, well, you're a smart guy. How can you watch that crap?
I tried to prove her wrong, and I couldn't. It was racist, and it was sexist, and it was a little homophobic and patriotism in a weird sort of way. But we sat down, we watched it, and fundamentally it's competition, but it's also fixed competition.
How go ahead, finish your sentence.
I was just gonna say it's a fixed competition, so they're always maximizing the drama at all times.
You know, they're loath to admit that it's a fixed competition. I used to work out with a guy named Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
Oh, yeah.
Who you reference in the play, as a matter of fact, Ricky Steamboat. Great guy, by the way. Terrific guy. But I asked him once, and he would not say. He would not commit to whether or not it was rigged. You're right up front about it. How do you know it was rigged?
Well, you know, that's changed a little bit. It used to be called kayfabe, which was an old carnival performer, a carny term. Where they were trying to get it over on the audience, who they called marks, and they were trying to make it seem that it was still legitimate competition. But in the last 10 to 15 years or so, for a number of reasons, they've come out into the forefront a little bit more and made it clear the World Wrestling Federation is now World Wrestling Entertainment. So they've put it right on the surface that you're not actually watching one guy drag the other guy by the back of his hair up and down the aisle. There's communication happening. So it becomes clear that what you're watching is actually more akin to kind of an improvisational dance with some storylines built behind it than, you know, say a basketball game.
So, Michael, what attracted you to this, and how does it fit into what CAST does, what it makes its bread and butter out of doing?
Well, I have to admit, I didn't know anything about this play until we were choosing this season, and we started by reading all the plays that had won the Pulitzer. Mm-hmm. Then we went to the list number two, which was all the plays that were the finalists for the Pulitzer, and that's when I came across this play. And when I read it and I understood the spectacle that was possible, it was, you know, it went to number one on our list. And, of course, you know, I'm not without having a great memory, and JR has worked for us before. And when I was reading it, I just saw JR as Chad. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that I thought was funny about this was it's a finalist for drama. And yet this is, I think,
fun.
The funniest play I've ever read. And to watch these guys in rehearsal with their wrestling and the dynamics that they have, Michael Smallwood, who plays Mace, not with us because he's in L.A. today, but it just helped us with the entire experience.
Talk about this, because first of all, you're the guy who wins. You, Chad Deity, is and that's an interesting choice of names for the guy who wins. you're the winner, but you're not the best wrestler. In fact, you're anything but the best. You're allowed to win because you're popular, and you're popular because you're allowed to win.
And he's good on the mic.
Okay. I'm good on the mic. I have charisma and a great smile. That's really all you need. And then you have to have somebody in the ring that's going to make you look good, which is Mace,
right,
who is actually a really great wrestler. It makes me look like I'm a better wrestler than I am.
Wow. Now, what did you have to do to prepare for this? Because you're an actor. You're not a wrestler. And that, it looks like that belt is taking all of your physical to carry around.
It's a pretty big belt. You got to be in shape for this. But we've been taking wrestling classes.
Really?
Every week, yes. I have to learn how to, you know, power bomb and body slam and all this. Because, like it says, you really do have to learn how to be safe.
So did that worry you at the beginning of this process when you I'm assuming you didn't know anything about wrestling when you started?
Well, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, I grew up watching wrestling.
But did you do it?
Me and my cousins, yeah, and okay. Not safely. By the way.
In their bedroom.
Yeah, exactly. This was in the bedroom, outside on the concrete, we're body slamming and power bombing.
Didn't your mama say, no throwing boys around the room?
No. Well, that's why we would go outside. You know, we could take that out. You really do have to learn how to be able to do these moves safely and make it look like you are, you know, destroying.
Have you gotten hurt?
No, not at all.
Really?
Not at all.
Well, it's the first time for everything.
I have to admit, you know, Chad Deity does not take any punishment. So I've been kind of lucky in the sense that I don't really have to take any of the moves.
Now, because this is radio, we encouraged you to show up in the outfit that you wear as a wrestler. And I'm told, obviously, you chickened out here. So what's it like?
My costume is it's a little cold for my costume. It's kind of why I opted out not to wear it. It's a very tight
Yeah. As I read this, what really struck me was the opening monologue, which goes on for pages and is not really a monologue. It's a monologue, and yet it switches in and out of being a monologue. It goes in and out of scenes and all the – and it's just rapid-fire philosophical descriptions of the history of wrestling and how it worked and sitting there as a kid in your underwear watching it on television. And it's brilliantly funny. How did you do that, Christopher? How did you write it?
You know, they say write what you know, and I've been fighting writing things that I knew for a long time and trying to write plays that I thought people wanted to see, and then I realized, you know, this was the thing that I watched when I was a kid. I watched wrestling obsessively, and that monologue, the whole play is sort of a monologue. I think you describe it really well. It folds in and out and folds into scenes, but that opening monologue is really a story of me and my cousins in Kruger Avenue in the Bronx, and how we sort of approach things differently. I was always sort of the nerdy kid who overthought stuff. And, you know, so how do you take the overthinking and turn it into something that other people maybe can understand?
This also seems
to be... Monologue sort of poured out.
Yeah, this script seems to play extremely well to the strengths of theater as opposed to movies or television or some other art form, because it finds a new, and to me at least, a refreshing way to use theater in the TV movie age. Did you find it that way as well?
I did. We call, matter of fact, the things that we say we do best are 35 millimeter theater. We try to find those pieces that are more cinematic and yet has to have the same opportunities and the wonderful energy of having live theater, and this particular work combines both of those.
Yeah, because there's TV mm-hmm. things in here, right?
Right. I mean, and matter of fact, we actually use two cameras, and we are projecting a lot of what you see on the screen at the same time. The action is in the ring. We're trying to embrace what we all grew up with watching this on TV, because, you know, and what I find interesting is I'm compelled, and I've, you know, obviously read the play a few times and seen JR wrestle once or twice, but when I'm watching him on the screen, 80% of my time I'm actually looking at the video projections and only 20% of the time at the live actors, and I think that's a product of how we grew up with television. Mm-hmm.
Just like professional wrestling is choreographed, this has to be even more choreographed, it seems to me. You've got to do the same thing at the same time every night. You could get yourself into really big trouble. With whom did you work to work all this out?
Well, we had a wrestling coach at the very beginning, but he kind of took a back seat, and we kind of – I've had stage combat training. Mm-hmm. We have a stage manager who was also – had stage combat right. training.
Our assistant director, Heather Bird, is also a fight choreographer. So between all three of them, and we've been attending wrestling matches since last August as well.
This is what's wrong with cast.
And Michael Smallwood comes home after rehearsal at, you know, we get home at 1 o'clock in the morning, and he's on cable television watching more wrestling.
This play not only satirizes professional wrestling, it takes on the ethnic stereotypes that the sport has historically played up and the political imagery that most people probably overlooked. And you saw all of this in professional wrestling, Christopher, and you saw the relationships among all three. How did that crystallize for you? When did that crystallize for you?
Yeah, you know, again, I'm talking about being the nerdy kid. As I got older, I started to stop. I started to stop divorcing the images that I saw from sort of the political ideas that I had. So when you start to think about art that way, you start to think about politics that way, you're always aware of sort of how people of color are being represented or how minority groups in general are being represented. And, you know, when you start to think about that, particularly when there's thousands of people chanting USA, USA, right. You know, and one guy is a bad guy because he's of Mexican descent, that's problematic. So how do you think about that and problematize it and put it into a dramatic form?
You've said that this is in response to what you see as a problem in American theater, one which makes it difficult for the audience to find the same kind of emotional connection that they might find in a sporting event. And this is kind of a sporting event / theatrical event. Is that how you solve the problem?
I think so. I think, you know, that chanting USA, one of the things that I love about this play is that we get the audience, specifically have the audience chanting, you know, for the pro-USA good guy sometime in one scene, and then we try to, in the very next moment, problematize it and have them cheering for the theoretical bad guy, or cheering for Chad Deity and then realizing there's some problems and you really want the other guy to beat him. So we figure if we can play with that a little bit, you start to get a tiny little sense of what it feels like to go to a boxing match or a baseball game. And it turns turns theater on its head a little bit.
Aside from the fact that Christopher Diaz, the playwright, is on the air with us this morning, have you worked carefully or closely with him in the course of developing and rehearsing this?
No, this is the first time we've actually had a chance to talk to him.
Really?
I know, we get to do it live on your show.
It's great to talk to you, Chris.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
You have any questions for him?
No, but I'd like statements of admiration. You know, the one thing you'd said earlier, and again, your writing is just so brilliant. It makes our job easy. But when we first decided to do this, you cannot believe how many people said, wait, you're going to do a play about wrestling? Are you crazy? Nobody's going to come to see a play about wrestling. And, you know, the line that you put in the end of the play is, this is what I use to convince everybody, look, don't decide ahead of time that people aren't going to come and see this because, you know, look at page 47 when you say, don't criticize my art form. You brought this up earlier. Don't criticize my art form for it being predetermined unless you're ready to criticize the swan for knowing it's already going to be dead.
Now, this opens on the 21st of March, of February, runs through the 23rd of March. It's a very hip, very modern approach to playmaking, and like other things where you put swimming pools on stage, you're staging this in a ring.
We are. We built our own wrestling ring, and we're going to have a contest to for the audience to figure out how many tires it actually took to put underneath the subfloor. And if you guess the right amount of tires, you get to wrestle with Chad Deity.
Michael, oh God.
I try to win my belt.
Michael Simmons and J.R. Jones are involved in the production. J.R. is Chad Deity, Michael Simmons is the artistic director. Christopher Diaz is the playwright of The Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity, February 21st to March 23rd at NCCast.com. Thanks for being with us.